actually introduce, make introductions here. Senator Burdick is the vice chair of the committee. And for folks in the audience and people that want to know how we're going to be scheduling bills, Senator Burdick and I are working on the bills that are being assigned to the committee and trying to identify those bills that neither of us have any particular difficulty with. So we'll have kind of a consent calendar until we begin the hearings, and then we'll find out if things explode and, you know, we start going towards different directions. So I'm happy to work with Senator Burdick and work with him in the past on the issues. And this session will prove to be exciting and fun since it's a very unique composition in the Senate with 15-15. So yesterday, I actually, it was my first meeting in the General Government Committee since 1989, serving under a Democratic chair. So it was a paradigm shift for me, too. So I'll have to relinquish some of my control here and try to get along. It's pretty tough for cops to do that. Senator Starr, you served on the Judiciary Committee, I think, in the House before with me in 97. I'm not sure if you did in 99. You've got judiciary experience. Charlie Ringo is the only practicing attorney on the committee. And you served on judiciary in the House, I believe, correct?
I think that's in the Senate also.
Is that right? Okay. And then, of course, Vicki served on judiciary in the House last session.
Two sessions.
And Ted, is this the first time you've ever served on judiciary?
It is, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to point out how we do have several recovering attorneys serving in the legislature.
Okay. All right. That's right.
Senator Brown.
All right. So we have some recovering attorneys, all of whom chose not to be on this committee. I don't tell you.
Part of the 12-step program.
Is that what it is?
Avoid the judiciary.
And then back, the primary counsel for this committee is going to be Craig Prince, who served with us during the 2001 session on a temporary basis, and then came back as permanent counsel with Bill Taylor. Bill is out here. Bill, you've been in the legislative process before I was born, I think, weren't you? 1987. So he's been around a long time. And then we have a new counsel, Bill Joseph, who's here on loan to us, I think, from the law firm of
Bullivant Hauser.
So we've got some top quality, very smart people here in this process. And your primary expertise is in the civil law area.
Correct.
And Craig's is mostly in criminal law. And then Bill Taylor's kind of a jack of all trades and a master of absolutely nothing. So but he's very, very, very smart. So if you need an answer to a question, you can certainly find that for you. And then we have Jane, is it Bodenweiser, is that correct? And you served with us last session with the committee, and she's like the key, the hub of the wheel, the brains of the outfit. She's the one that makes this thing run, along with Patsy, who orders all of us around. Patsy is not in the room.
She's monitoring.
All of us answer to
Hello,
Patsy. Who's a lovely woman. Patsy, you're very lovely, and we appreciate you. Appreciate all of the judiciary staff. The other thing is, I think we're running this session with less staff people, three or four positions than we did in the 2001 session. So everybody's going to be some degree taxed trying to move bills through the process, and particularly the committee staff. So we'll try to work with them, and if they start turning, you know, beet red when you ask them to do one more thing, I'm sure they'll be very temperate in their response to you and say yes ma'am or yes sir and go off and complain to each other in their office or something. They'll get it done. So if you guys could just cooperate with them and try to do your best to help lighten the load where you can. But the intent of the chair is, again, to work with Patsy. There's Patsy. I'm ready to wave to Patsy. Appreciate it. The intent of the chair is to work closely with my vice chair and move bills judiciously through the process and in an attempt to write good law. And I think my little deal, being a non-attorney, is being a detective. I like the keen sense for the obvious. I like the law when we write it to say what we mean. I don't like sometimes legalese where lawyers, they seem to think they understand it, but nobody in private life can understand what the heck they just said. And I drive legislative counsel nuts because I like to be redundant where necessary. I like to make sure that the record is clear, if possible, with respect to where we're going. So with that, I don't know if anybody else has any comments or wants to wants to share. Charlie, do you want to say anything at all?
No, I'm honored to be on this committee. I look forward to working with you.
We'll see if you say that inside your guy.
I'm not saying I'm always going to agree.
Well, I have to say I'm probably one of the better chairs in the entire building.
Mr. Chairman, I second that motion.
I like to tend to run things pretty relaxed. You know, I served in the minority party back in the 80s with the Republicans in the Senate, and it was very different because everything was run strictly by the rules. And I think, Bill, you remember some of those times when, you know, you had motions coming from the right and motions coming from the left, and the chair had to really be on the ball trying to keep up with the parliamentary procedure. I like to keep it a little bit more relaxed if possible. We have to follow the parliamentary procedure issues. Otherwise, I hear from the Secretary of the Senate who will show up at my doorstep and say, Senator Menes, you just made a big mistake. So if we can keep that kind of posture, and the other thing I like, I'm very much into letting people say what they need to say, even if they disagree with the direction of the chair or whatever. So there you go. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say what a pleasure it is to be serving on this committee with this group, and just to point out this is really a historic time for the Oregon Senate and for this committee, because we have an even split, and the responsibility of all of us to really work together is higher than it is even under the best of times for this body. So I'm really looking forward to making history in the judiciary tradition, which is very professional and inclusive.
The other thing I have to say, too, I served with Senator Burdick on the negotiating team to put the rule structure for the Senate together. She's a tough, tough negotiator. She really is. I thought I was bad. But she is really tough. And her very, very strong. Kept us all off guard. So anybody needs a good negotiator they want to send in first, he's definitely somebody else.
Likewise, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely. Ted, any comments?
Sir, none. Thank you.
Nothing? Okay. Did you like it, the short straw?
Actually, I negotiated for this committee.
Excellent. Vicki?
Happy to be here. I feel a little bit like the new student who's sitting next to the teacher.
You might be strangling anybody into this.
Yeah, or you'll be asking to look at my notes, because I keep pretty darn good notes.
Okay,
so
that's right.
Yeah.
Now you're a court reporter.
A court reporter, have been for almost 20 years.
So you're like addicted to notes and stuff, right?
Yeah, I find it's the best way to get around and make sure that people remember what they said and what I think Bill really said. And so it works pretty well. Though as a court reporter, too, I tend to not like it when people talk more than they need to by saying the same thing over again. And I really don't like people who read their testimony. It's so much better if you highlight your testimony and give us eye contact, because we can read it faster than you can. And I disengage when people start reading their testimony. So most of the regular lobbyists in this building know that, and I hope they remember to do that. It just makes us more engaged in what you're trying to tell us.
And I just wrote down big notes. Does not like redundant covers. That's the other thing I wanted to mention. I'm going to try to, and I don't know what to work out with counsel here, to try to post a limitation on testimony to try to manage the time, mm-hmm. and the time if possible. And actually, it's interesting. In 1997, or it could have been 87 or 85, I can't remember. I was a minority member of the Judiciary Committee, and there some nice lady was giving her heartfelt testimony, and it went on and on and on and on. And I finally asked for recognition, and I asked this lady if that was her doctoral dissertation, only to be told that that was her. She was on her last paragraph, so to be kind of careful with people sometimes. Yeah. All right. Does not like redundant commentary. Senator Starr, comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came to work, and I appreciate the opportunity to serve here. This is I'm going to be a busy committee, and we have, because of our large agenda, I think it's important that we be here on time and get rolling every morning. And so I'll pledge to be here with my cup of coffee to this going.
Right. I appreciate those comments, too. Kind of got off to a little bit of a rocky start yesterday, but punctual. Senator Starr wants us to be punctual. I think that's a good, that's a very good thing. And respectful. I think that's one of the things that I've learned over the process is to try to be respectful of people regardless of their opinions. And I tell you, sometimes you get tied up in this stuff and it gets pretty emotional and it's hard. But I guess ask the committee to be respectful of each other and their opinions and views and such on and so forth. So now we've got a couple of meetings that we need to
Mr. Chairman, thank you, members of the committee. I wanted to make a couple of announcements for some things that staff has been working on for you, particularly on February 3rd and 4th. Bill Taylor and Robin Lamont down in Ways and Means have been working on a joint meeting to map out the public safety process, how it works, with an eye to educating all of you to let you know what we're going to, you know, what's going to be costing the money, I guess, basically. I think their focus is going to be on showing if you, for example, if you affect the system in one area, is it going to just overlap into another, which I think is going to be one of the folks. I know Ann Christian's been working on that. Several of the people, it's we're trying to make it very inclusive of the whole system. It's going to be in Ways and Means on February 3rd and 4th. Bill, do we have a time for that yet?
It'll be 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Okay.
The combined meeting of at least the House Judiciary Committee and Public Safety Subcommittee. Ways and Means. I'm not sure if Senator can be there. This is the state of the schedule.
What day is it?
3rd and 4th.
But do you know what day? Is it like Thursday, Friday?
Oh. Wednesday,
Thursday.
I think the day is
Wednesday.
Thursday, Friday. If that's the 3rd and
4th,
I don't have a calendar in front of me.
Okay. All right.
Monday, Tuesday, says Ann Christian.
Monday,
Tuesday.
Okay.
The other thing that week would be on Thursday, February 6th. The National Institute of Corrections has, I'm working with them and Claudia Black from our own Department of Corrections, to get Professor Ed Latessa to come speak, and he can, I think we'll have him available for both our normal time and the House's normal time. He is recognized as one of, I think, the top thinker or PhD on basically what works in corrections to lower recidivism. He is one of the people nationally who does what's called meta-analysis, which means he has taken, you know, all the different studies that people do of, say, boot camps and early Head Start programs and all these things. He looks at them through the nation to try to figure out what works best, basically. Where are the dollars spent best to lower crime, essentially? That will be February 6th. I'm still working out the details, so I think we can say that he is going to make it out. And I think... we've worked it out that would be, Mr. Chair, at the normal time, if that's your preference.
Right. And if committee members have an interest in touring parts of the criminal justice system, let me know, or let staff know.
Yeah.
I can arrange that out. From time to time, the Department of Corrections will facilitate tours to the various prison facilities or Oregon Youth Authority if you're inclined to do that. We might be able to facilitate ride-alongs with law enforcement if we want to do that. We generally have a meeting with the Supreme Court during special session.
Set that in later
session. I'm stuck on special session stuff. So we'll have a lunch generally with the Supreme Court, which is always instructional for me. I learn a lot from them, just kind of getting some side conversations about how they interpret the law and what's profitable, what isn't. By the way, we're kind of stalling on purpose because we can't really adopt our rules until 8:37. So if anybody out there has anything they'd like to say to us, I saw...
Any singers or dancers?
Singers, dancers. Anybody out there that wants to say something? No? Okay, well, let's do a real quick recess for like 10 minutes. Recharge. 8:37.
I think that's a fabulous idea.
subject to the same rules adopted by other committees and their standard here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's correct. I hope you've had a chance to review the model committee rules. They are straight from the ones that you've worked on with your caucuses and Judy Hall. I would try to go through them, but I'm afraid they're technical enough that I don't want to misspeak anything. I think the substantive changes, as you probably know, are, for example, on page 2, the minority reports, number 12, I think, is a substantive change from the past. Number 13, I want you to note, too, is an interesting one regarding amendments. Proposed amendments by other than members of the assembly must be submitted in writing to the committee staff at least 48 hours prior to the work session at which they are to be considered. And then I see it says the chair may waive the requirement of this rule. I noted that one because I'm the one getting late amendments. So if there's any, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at them, if there's any questions, be happy to go over them. But I think they're definitely the ones that you've all agreed to in the other committees.
All right. Anybody have questions on this? Senator?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make the comment that I've made in my other committees that I would hope that I actually prefer 48-hour notice of committee meetings to allow citizens the rank and file out there to attend. And if possible, I'd like to be able to do that. But more importantly, I would like to be able to have testimony by video conferencing if that comes available to at any time during this committee, because we have a lot of folks who live in the rural parts of the state who can't get here, and if they truly want to testify, I'd like to do whatever we can to try to set that up. There is an organization called OPAN, similar to C-SPAN, that's trying to make the legislature more accessible through video conferencing as well and television broadcasts. And I would just like to our committee to be open to that.
Which reminds me to remember that we're all on television all the time, so be very careful what you say or what you do. We see some very audacious things. Senator, that's a good idea. If we can, we will. I don't know. Do we have any AV guys that are really good at that kind of stuff?
I don't know if we have video yet.
We'll have to check in and just see. But I certainly would accommodate that. And actually, if we get a real no-kidding normal, like, citizen person who walks in here, we will honor them and cherish them. Not that we don't cherish the rest of you.
Without my glasses, I can't see who they are anyway.
So it does get to be kind of a proprietary system sometimes. Mm-hmm. Any heartburn or other questions on the rules? Madam Vice Chair.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just think that the suggestion about videotape is good, and I don't see any conflict with that.
Right.
I understand.
All right. Just kind of hoping for a motion to adopt the rules.
Mr. Chairman, I move we adopt the Senate Model Committee rules for the 2003 session.
Thank you very much. Senator Burdick moves that we adopt the Senate Model Committee rules. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? No opposition. The motion passes. We now have committee rules. We can move forward. We're going to move forward this morning with some public hearings on Senate Bill 32 is first. Council, do you want to give us a...
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chair. I will address the committee as Mr. Chairman without no disrespect to Madam Vice Chair, but I think it might just be quicker to move things along if that's okay.
That's absolutely correct.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 32 was introduced by the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary, the request of the Oregon State Bar Elder Law Section. It deals with modification of the rules regarding court visitors in protective proceedings. This was a pilot program started in Multnomah County called the Multnomah County Protective Proceeding Pilot Project. It sunsets on December 31st, 2003. This measure would remove the sunset provision and expand the program to all counties and also adds a provision providing for appointment of counsel in certain protective proceedings. Court visitors are persons appointed by the court to visit protected persons, people who have had a guardian appointed to them, and the visitor does certain evaluations as to whether the guardianship is working, is it still needed, are there modifications, and this program would continue after the sunset period and be expanded to all counties, is my understanding. Apparently there is one amendment that is in the works, and I believe that if you look on page 2, section 3, which is amending section 13, it's my understanding that now section 13 will be removed, but maybe some of the witnesses have some more information on that. And I can take any questions from the committee, and I don't know other witnesses.
Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee, my name is Susan Gravy. I'm with the Oregon State Bar Public Affairs Program, and we appreciate the opportunity to be here to speak today. We have a number of bar volunteers here to speak on a number of different bills in front of you. To start off with is Dady Blake with the Elder Law Section on Senate Bill 32.
Good morning, Madam Vice Chair and members of the committee. My name again is Dady Blake. I'm an elder law attorney in the Portland, Oregon area. And co-chair of the legislative committee for the elder law section of the bar. I work primarily in taking on protective proceeding cases, that is guardianship, conservatorship. I also work Medicaid, Medicare, and deal with elder abuse both in the civil area and frequently as a witness in criminal prosecutions. I'm here today in support of SB 32, Senate Bill 32. As Mr. Joseph has explained, this bill would extend the pilot project which has been going on in Multnomah County. Additionally, we sought to remove from that pilot project certain provisions that the court has found to be onerous. And in this time of fiscal constraints and budget concerns, I think it's especially important. There were provisions in the original pilot program that required additional hearings and court oversight. Those are the provisions that are in this Section 13 that had not been deleted, and we were asking to be deleted at the court's request, and we agree with that. The section agrees with that. This bill is important because it expands the role of the court visitor in ensuring that a protected person of the ward estate has their rights protected. It defines what the court visitor's role is more specifically than had been done before in our protective proceeding statute. It explains the rights. The court visitor is required to explain the rights to a protected person in person, their rights, their right to an attorney, their right to a hearing. They explain and read to them the documents that have been presented to the court. They ask them if they want to object. This had not been required prior to the pilot project. Some counties were doing it, hit and miss, but it had not been required in any consistent fashion. We think this is very important that the protected person has their rights enforced, and by expanding the role of the court visitor, that has been allowed to happen more consistently in Multnomah County. And that is why we were asking that it be extended. But again, with the provisions that make it more difficult or put on a burden on the courts for oversight, we're asking those provisions be deleted from that program. That's all my comments are. Do any of you have any questions on this bill that I may answer?
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? No questions? Thank you very much.
Oh, I did want to add that Ann Christian of the Office of State Court Administrators has expressed to me that she would like to meet and to confirm that this is the best solution, and we are planning to do that this week and to get back to you no later than next week.
Well, we have the good fortune of having Ann Christian next on our list.
I'm so good.
For her personally. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ann Christian. Today I'm wearing the hat representing the Oregon Judicial Department as opposed to Indigent Defense. And I want to commend the hard work, actually, of Multnomah County in undertaking the pilot program that has been described. And with this bill having just been seen by us, I can tell you that during the 1999 legislative session, where there was legislation to make what Multnomah County has been doing on a pilot process a statewide program. We found that there was such a disparity within the local counties as far as how guardianships were handled. And we thought that pilot testing the proposed procedures in Multnomah County was a good thing, and in fact, we supported that. And with the shortness of the hearing, based upon my experience in 1999 in discovering the divergence of practices within the local communities and the local courts, I have requested that we have an opportunity to have just a small group meet within the next week to make sure that this bill, and I think it has the best from Multnomah County from the pilot, but to make sure that it will work, particularly in the rural counties. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 32? Okay. We'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 32 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 35. We have, first of all, Council, can you summarize Senate Bill 35?
Thank you, Madam Vice Chairman. Senate Bill 35 was introduced at the request of the Joint Interim Committee on Judiciary at for the Oregon State Bar Elder Law Section. Senate Bill 35 requires prior court approval of payment for compensation to persons employed as a fiduciary when they hire somebody, specifically a family member or someone else that they have a relationship with, to conduct services on behalf of a protected person. When those services are going to be paid for out of the protected person's funds, apparently a conflict of interest arises when a fiduciary acting on behalf of the protected person seeks to hire somebody to undertake services for the protected person, and the fiduciary has a relationship with the person sought to be hired, and the person being hired will be paid by funds of the fiduciary. These situations are not given the same amount of scrutiny as our transactions where the fiduciary is hiring a third party not connected with the fiduciary to act on behalf of the protected person. The Elder Law Section would like to amend Oregon law to require a more detailed hearing regarding the appropriateness of hiring somebody connected with or who has a relationship with the fiduciary before that action is undertaken for greater protection to the protected person. I understand that we probably have some witnesses who would like to testify on this bill.
We have one person signed up. Mr. Blake? Is it? No.
Yes. Mr. Blake.
Is it Dave? What's your first
Good
name?
Good morning, Chair.
Davey is your first
Davey name? Davey Blake. Yeah. Davey Catherine Blake.
By the way, I'm an expert at butchering everyone. So.
That's all right. As a child, I always got mail that said Master Davey Blake. I got used to it. For the benefit of the chair, I'll reintroduce myself. I am an elder law attorney and work in the Portland area. My work primarily consists of guardianship, conservatorship, or protective proceeding work. I also do some work in Medicaid, Medicare, and work in both the civil and criminal area in elder abuse, called on as a witness in the for criminal prosecution of people who abuse the elderly in Multnomah County. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 35, which Mr. Joseph has summarized, I think, fairly well, and there's not a whole lot to add. This bill did come out of concern that fiduciaries were paying their family members, fiduciary of a protected person, either a conservator typically, was paying their family members without getting prior court approval. To pay themselves, a fiduciary must get court approval, but they were paying family members, relatives for work. And the court felt, as the elder law section agrees, that this should require court approval and scrutiny to discourage misuse and abuse of a protected person's funds. To my knowledge, there is really no one that has expressed any concern about this bill. I think it's widely accepted. Are there any questions that you may have?
I have a couple of questions. Could you help me understand when this law would kick in? When would this apply?
The situation where it would apply?
Correct.
A protected person who is unable or incapable of handling financial matters has a conservator appointed for them. Conservator is then authorized to use that person's funds and assets for the benefit of the protected person. The conservator, perhaps, I've seen situation, for example, where a conservator's husband had a contracting business. The conservator paid her husband, contracting business, enormous sums of money to remodel the protected person's home. There weren't competitive bids, etc. The court, when reviewing the accounting, simply saw, you know, Joe Schmo's construction company, right. You know, $42,000. There had been no pre-approval. There had been, and, you know, there's a clear risk of not entering into arm's length transaction with the family member, not getting the possible best bid, and quite frankly, not even having the work done and simply paying someone and making it look like you were actually getting work done. So,
if it helped me, remind me, how do people get in this? They're a protected person is somebody who obviously is incapable.
That's correct.
But then they get into the system and they get a conservator appointment.
That's right.
How?
A conservator is appointed by the court once someone petitions,
right.
Typically a family member. The most common situation is a child, adult child, will petition the court and say their mother or father has Alzheimer's disease or has had multiple strokes to the point where they're incapable of handling financial matters. The court sends out a court visitor. Well, in the case of a conservator, may not, but there may be a court visitor involved. There may be investigation of whether or not that's true, review doctor's records, etc. But if the court makes a determination that, in fact, the person is not capable of making financial decisions and has finances that are at risk. So typically this doesn't happen where you have absolutely nothing, but you have finances that need management or at risk. The court will appoint someone. Usually it's the petitioner. The child who has petitioned the court is typically the person that is seeking appointment as their parent's
right.
conservator.
Right.
And again, in situations I've seen, they then may then pay their son or daughter to do the lawn work. That's usually harmless. But this bill would cover all such instances.
Help me understand mm-hmm. that. So we go through this process and say you come to me, I'm the judge, and you say, you know, mom's losing it, she needs to have a conservator. I say, yeah, you're right, mom's losing it, so you're the conservator, correct?
Right.
Okay, now how would this bill apply?
Okay, this bill would say that before I pay my husband or my children to work for mom out of mom's funds. I mean, I could pay out of my own funds,
right.
But before I pay out of mom's funds, I must seek court approval. Exactly, for every expenditure. And if there are ongoing expenditures, as we have had, what I do in my practice, if it's likely that a child, for example, is going to be a care provider, that's a very common situation. One child petitions for conservatorship and or guardianship over a parent. That parent may be living or soon to be living with another child
right.
who will be the caregiver. And we just tell the court right up front, son or daughter are going to be providing care in their home, and they are going to be charging X amount in rent and X amount for their caregiving services.
Right.
And they are to be paid monthly, and we get that pre-approval in advance.
So that contract becomes part of the court order.
That's right. That's right.
Part of the appointment of the
right.
conservator.
Yes.
Okay, good. Any questions?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Has there been analysis done of court resources and time necessary on this? I mean, have you gotten feedback from the courts on how much of a burden this is going to be?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Senator Burdick. This request actually came out from the courts. They were tired of seeing things in accountings that hadn't been disclosed beforehand or that they were suspicious of, that hadn't been forthright, the conservator hadn't been forthright about information. And it came out of concern and the time it took them at that point to then reject, ask what it was about. We have, and again, this came from the court's request to do this type of thing. We are not expecting that it would add to the burden of the court. It's a very good question. What we think will happen is what we hope to happen, is that it will discourage people from actually paying family members when they have to do so at an arm's length and have to provide full disclosure, that they will discourage them from inappropriately doing it. Again, as I was mentioning in response to the chair's question, once attorneys are aware that this needs to be done, as I do in my own practice, we will seek pre-approval for things, and it will be part of a regular petition. So it should not require extra burden of the court in oversight.
I think given the times we're in, I think that's a question that I'm going to be asking everybody who comes
understandably.
The court and the budget situation that they're in.
Yeah,
thank you very
understandably.
Much.
Any other questions? Oh, sorry.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just a little bit concerned because there wasn't a dollar amount listed, and I can see situations where we have lots of requests for small expenditures. Of course, that's one way that a fiduciary, if they're trying to bulk one of the protected persons, is to make lots of little small transactions.
Right.
But, you know, for instance, my husband and I took care of my father-in-law, and we had a housekeeper come in every month to clean because I just didn't have all that time. Is that an expenditure that someone goes to court for if you're a court-appointed fiduciary? That, you know, that that's a regular expense, as you said.
Right. Under this bill, there is not a dollar amount limited, so that if you had your daughter routinely being paid, let's say I'm the conservator again for my mother, just to keep it in a simple example, and I used my mom's funds to pay my daughter, her granddaughter, who would come in on a weekly basis to clean the house. Under this bill, you would have to alert the court in advance. And to save on time, you would generally would do so in your initial petition. These services are provided by family members. These are the rates that are charged. These rates are comparable or less than what we have in the general community for the same service. But yes, you would. But you would not have to do that for expenditures that weren't going to family members. Clearly, if you're hiring a cleaning lady to come in and clean mom's house, I would not have to tell the court about that. That would be an ordinary expenditure. And by far, most expenditures that you see in conservatorships do not involve family members.
Right.
It's just the ones that come in and you're, again, it's not clearly identified because it's the name of a company, but maybe it's owned by a spouse or a family member. The court would like that to be identified.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Any other questions? Senator Perry-Wolling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm detecting a little illogic here.
Okay.
And I'm hoping that the testimony of the witness will clear it up for me. The conservator process requires the family members or the petitioner to petition the court. And it precipitates a meeting between the court and the petitioner. And there's an interrogative process. There's witnesses, potentially. There's documentary evidence about the capacity of the object of the petition. And at that point in time, couldn't the court, of its own volition, without any change in statute, simply direct the conservator not to expend any dollars in the conservatorship in contracts or agreements with family members and make that part of the order?
There would be nothing to keep a judge from, or the court on its own motion to do that. We are seeking this to be part of the law, that it is a requirement to do so. I think that to do otherwise requires the court to have their own rulings related to the statute. Essentially, you're asking them to impose something that's not found in the statute as it is now. And it is the judges themselves that are dealing with this that have asked us to change the law so that it is uniform, and it is in the law that everyone has noticed that they're supposed to do this.
Mr. Chairman, the the logic I found here is that we're not requiring anything of attorneys. We're requiring something of judges. We're removing the discretion of the judge to make a judgment about the capacity and integrity of the conservator that's making the petition. Basically ordering the judge to say, you must disclose and limit your expenditures with family members. And the judge has the authority to do that already. You know, I guess the what I find illogical is we're requiring judges to pursue a remedy that's already currently within their authority to pursue. If they want to make that order, they just add it to the conservatorship order, and make it an order of the court when they create the conservatorship. So I guess I see this as... I'm going to have to hear a lot more testimony, okay, Mr. Chairman, from someone inside the judicial branch that's making these decisions about why they need to be told that they have to require this disclosure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good point. Respond.
Sure, I'd love to respond. Thank you. This does put the burden on the attorneys to disclose, and then that's we're hoping to shift the burden from, and perhaps haven't explained very well, hoping to shift the burden from a judge or someone reviewing accountings that are submitted annually. In the normal conservatorship process, you have a requirement of an annual accounting. You must report to the court all expenditures, and those are listed in a general ledger form, not typically with a lot of detail. This requires the attorneys who are putting those forms together and the conservator who is putting that information together to disclose this information. And again, under the statute, they're disclosing it in advance so that this isn't coming later at the accounting period, at the end of the year, at the end of the conservator's year after being appointed, but coming before they've made expenditures to a family member. So the real hope of the amendment is to take it away from the court to be, to be finding these things, but to put the burden in the statute under the conservator to be reporting and seeking permission to before making these types of payments to family members to ensure that they are reasonable and that therefore services actually provided and that are necessary. I guess I want to make sure this is clear. In the process, judges typically do not, it's very rare when judges will order something beyond what is authorized in the statute. Judges have discretion to do things, to make orders on their own motion based on what they see as a need for a protected person. There is some general language in the statute to that end. But generally, they don't do that. Generally, they don't review each case specifically and make that kind of blanket announcements in their courts. That's true in most courts. There may be one court that there's a judge who does a little more of that than others, but generally that is not the case. So this would be put into law to relieve the burden really from the judges from having to do this so that all conservators would be held to this standard of if they are going to be paying family members that the least, and that's okay, but they need to do it at fair market value, not at exorbitant prices, and for services are provided. And the court will especially want to know about large expenditures and question those. So our hope is that it will discourage that type of use of money, which has happened. Does that answer your concern, Senator?
Mr. Chairman, no. Okay. Mr. Chairman, I still haven't heard whether or not the... it's my contention that judge already has the discretion and the authority to make additional orders if they so desire based on their analysis of the conservatorship petition, the demeanor and the capacity of the petitioner and so on and so forth. So we're actually being asked to constrain the discretion of the court in an area where they already have jurisdiction and authority.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Rago.
I guess it's my thinking that a lot of judges aren't that careful. And
glad you said that.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind telling the judges that. And this is simply designed to build in a safeguard to protect the funds of a protected person. To give the court guidance that says, we think this is a good thing, and you ought to have this when you have a conservatorship or other protected entity. It just makes sense. And I think Senator Farioli is right. The court already has that discretion right now, but there's certainly no harm in building in that protection into the statute to protect assets of somebody that is a protected person.
All right. We have one other person who's
It was Jennifer Wright. We did have another person who was going to testify.
There's someone who sent me a note, Mr.
Okay. Cooper. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, do we have any judges that have submitted briefs on this or lined up to testify that they need this statute?
No.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well,
Mr. Cooper.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Madam Vice Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Brooks Cooper. I'm an attorney practicing in a slightly different area of elder law than Ms. Blake does. My firm routinely represents protected persons, their families or estates, after their funds have been lost or dissipated in efforts to recover them. And I wanted to address Senator Farioli's questions to Ms. Blake very quickly and offer a slightly different viewpoint into why I think SB 35 is useful for the courts. I do agree with the senator that any judge has the authority to make restrictions in an order appointing a conservator, such as the restrictions that this bill would require. The reason that I think it's valuable is for a number of reasons. First, many of these proceedings go on for a number of years, and circumstances change where family members may not be in the business that is ultimately going to be used by the protected person. There may be no indicia at the time that the petitioner is appointed conservator that this is even a possibility. Second, the conservator themselves may at the time of appointment not have any improper or nefarious or malfeasing intent, but the effect of having control over a checkbook with $300,000 or $400,000 of someone else's money in it can be corrosive for some people over time. The court would not have been aware of that at the time the petition was entered. And finally, many circumstances where the family agrees that the protected person does need assistance, there's no contested proceeding, the family agrees that this son or this daughter or cousin is an appropriate fiduciary, the court has very limited contact with that fiduciary prior to their appointment. These fiduciaries report to the court on an annual basis, and so frequently, if this behavior has been going on, the court finds out about it a year later. And in a year, I've seen in my practice irreparable damage to someone's finances so that when they should not need to, they frequently end up on state assistance for many years in their life. All of this put together, I think, makes this a useful prerequisite, just like the criminal background checks, just like all of the other fiduciary disclosures we require, no matter how trustworthy the person seems. That, to me, seems to be the benefit of SB 35, not to restrain an incautious judiciary, but to simply assist them in situations where they wouldn't have a reason to impose this condition until after the damage had occurred. I'd be happy to answer any of the committee's questions.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cooper, that raised a question in my mind. Why are the reports only annual? Do you think a semi-annual reporting period would be more helpful to alerting the court to any malfeasance?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I don't think increasing the reporting period would help because, number one, it would create a substantial burden on court staff. The reports are relatively voluminous. They require review by court staff and ultimately by a judge before approval. Luckily, these situations don't happen very often, but when they do happen, it's, as you can expect, devastating for the person and the family. I've handled a number of instances where we've had folks who've ended up spending the last 7 or 8 years of their life on Medicaid when only 8 or 9 years ago they had $750,000, and so the state should not be paying, but it's been dissipated. So it's a minor circumstance, and I don't think that sort of a drastic across-the-board measure would really catch much of this wrongdoing quicker.
And as a follow-up, so to answer Senator Farioli's question, then the suggestion to do it on a semi-annual basis would be quite burdensome to the court, whereas this suggestion is much less burdensome on the court and really puts the onus on the fiduciary to be acting in the best interest of a protected person.
I would agree with that, and if I might offer just a very short view into the way that this, if this bill is passed, would occur on a regular basis. Most practitioners who've looked at this issue, many of whom proactively already do this because we think it's the right thing to do, if, for example, the husband's contracting company was going to be installing the wheelchair ramps that are now needed in the home, the petition submitted for approval for that would attach bids from two or three independent companies and say, look, it's in the median, it's below the average of those. This would be a pro forma approval by the court if it's appropriate. We're not talking about a hearing and an evidentiary proceeding and taking up half a day of a judge's time. And obviously those who would want to bilk a person would be discouraged from filing these things because then the court would stop it before it occurred.
Thank you.
Well, I'm getting more confused as we talk about this because if I'm reading Section 1 of the bill, which is current law, it already says that the judge may do all of this stuff. So,
correct.
Is Senator Farioli apparently is absolutely right. Judges are simply not doing what the statutes already allow them to do.
Yes.
So it begs the question then, if we change the law and make it more clear what authority they have, that somehow they're going to suddenly do things that they were previously empowered to do. I guess I just don't quite understand. You know, if judges aren't going to do their jobs, they're not going to do their job. So help me understand how this is going to help.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I wouldn't look at it as a circumstance of judges not doing their jobs.
Well, you're saying they are doing their jobs then.
I think the judges are doing their jobs, but this occurs rarely enough that this is not something that judges routinely have in the front of their minds, that this prospective conservator in front of me might commit this malfeasance in the future.
But judges aren't stupid. Judges understand human nature.
Yes.
They sit in criminal court. They watch people do stupid things all the time.
Sure.
So, I mean, if I'm reading this thing correctly, they already have this power. They're just not doing it.
They do have this power. They are not currently doing it.
In fact, they can order additional financial disclosures if they choose, but they're not doing it.
Many times judges restrict accounts entirely, certainly.
Okay. And in Multnomah County, don't we have judges, or you don't know if Multnomah County or not.
I am.
Generally have judges that sit and do this kind of law on a continual basis?
Yeah, this is
long periods of time?
The chief probate judge in Multnomah County sits as probate and family law judge and handles the majority of these, so we do have a lot of continuity there.
So Senator Farioli is right, though.
Absolutely.
Judges simply are not doing their job.
I disagree with that characterization.
That's because you're a member of the bar. You have to. I'm not a member of the bar. I can say that. Senator Burdick.
May I intervene here?
Yes, of course.
The way I'm hearing this is that the judge has the authority to do this already, but what this does is this puts the burden on the attorneys to highlight the situation, or was to identify this kind of situation exists, and to highlight it for the judge, and then the judge could for sure see it. In the vast numbers of all these cases, you know, with thousands and thousands of cases where a family member is not involved in any kind of fiduciary responsibility, and this would require put the burden on the attorneys to highlight it. So I see this as kind of a practical issue rather than a substantive issue. Is that a correct interpretation?
That's certainly the way that I would view it. This is simply another check in the system in the same way that the required background check is placed in the system. Even if the conservator appears to be a pillar of the community, we still do the background check. We still do the disclosures of various things in their background. Have you had a bankruptcy? Have you had a criminal conviction, etc.? So I see this as a measure to stop those limited few people who would prospectively attempt to mislead the court. I promise, Judge, I won't do that. And then a year later, you find out it's been done. That's the circumstance I see. Asking judges to spend hours and hours and hours of judicial time interrogating people, most of whom don't have any bad intent, and you do it well. It seems to me to be a waste of resources when we can place this onus on the few fiduciaries who want to employ family in these circumstances.
Are you glad you came up here?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, the question for the witness. Is the fiduciary required to make some sort of indemnification against fraud or deceit?
Good
is
question.
Is there a binding requirement for the fiduciary?
Good question, Mr. Chairman, Senator. Two-part answer to that. First, whether or not there is a bond, the fiduciary is personally liable, and the court has the jurisdiction to surcharge that person for any losses through negligence, malfeasance, nonfeasance of the protected person's assets during their service. That can always be done. The practical problem is, many times, we have no money. So we have $500,000 of grandma's money go away, and we've got someone who has functionally no assets to speak of, and so they're uncollectible. We can require that they be bonded. And in many, many circumstances, the person is bonded, but the cost of the bond comes out of the protected person's funds. Now, the bond ultimately does make them whole if there's a loss, but that cost is often prohibitive. And once again, we're back to punishing or making onerous procedural requirements on the vast majority of individuals who will not commit this conduct to deter the very, very few, where this circumstance places the onus on the very few to prospectively come forward without necessarily increasing the cost of the majority of conservatorships where this legislation won't have any effect because they won't do anything wrong.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the contention here is that the burden would be placed not on the courts but on the attorneys.
On the fiduciary and their counsel. That's the way I would read it.
And Mr. Chairman, if the burden is on the fiduciary and their counsel, then the cost is to the trustor.
Correct. But the only time this...
Mr. Chairman, the cost is to the trustor, whether they're paying the fiduciary's attorney or whether they're posting a bond against future malfeasance. Mr. Chairman, there is no law that is effective against the person who intends to defraud. You know, if malfeasance is in the heart of the fiduciary, then no amount of law is going to change that behavior. And it's only after the fact that these things are discovered. I think it'd be far better, Mr. Chairman, if we looked at some kind of a mechanism that increases the fiduciary's liability or requires indemnification, even if it comes from the trustor's estate, than we are to put an additional burden for an annual report, which is another paper chase, which will increase the cost to the trustor and increase the court's burdens, regardless of what we've heard here today. I just don't see this as being effectual. It duplicates authority that already exists at the bank.
All right, Senator, here we go.
I'm a little taken aback that an effort by people whose profession is looking out for the possessions of people that are mentally ill and often need substantial financial resources. And we're trying to build in accountability. We're trying to build in a step so that those resources are protected. And here are people who spend their lives in this system, and they think this would be a good way to add a small measure of additional accountability. It seems very odd to me that people outside the system are saying, no, we don't think you know your job, and this isn't really a good way to protect those assets. The reason there's an annual report is so that the court can have a little bit of accountability. Every now and then they step back, they look at an account, they look at the funds going in, the funds going out, and everybody knows there's going to be that checkup done. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that. And all this is doing is adding a little bit of protection to make it more difficult for people who may self-deal with family members. Right?
Sorry. I don't disagree with what you're saying, and the bill on the surface is fine, but it's a small step that I think Senator Farrell is right with respect to the fact that the authority exists here. In fact, the authority is pretty expansive.
So the courts can do anything when they set up conservatorship. They can make somebody wear green pants when they
right.
want to come and do their account.
Right.
They could do anything.
I mean, it already says in Section 1 that a fiduciary may employ a person in which the fiduciary has pecuniary or financial interest only after disclosing the nature of the interest. So my assumption is then that fiduciaries do disclose the nature of their interest, correct? And my assumption then would, judges don't usually interrogate people, they usually just question them, interrogation of the police. However, it is clear to me that they're not doing what they have the authority to do, so I'm not sure that adding this shall, that means you're going to have the judge's signature on a piece of paper. I kind of like Senator Farrell's direction where he's going, the idea of bonding. Posting a bond, because you know as well as I do that some of the people that end up with grandma's $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 are individuals who squander this money on drugs and other things, you know. And it does happen quite frequently, actually.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cooper, maybe you can enlighten members of the committee. I've had experience of purchasing a bond to have stocks transferred into my husband and his brother's name since his father's death. It's not cheap, is it, Mr. Cooper?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, you're absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Imposing an across-the-board bonding requirement where, as you pointed out, the court has substantial discretion to do other things to protect the assets, and I'll mention those in just a moment, I think would simply serve to dissipate the funds of many, many protected people, increase the likelihood they'd end up on state assistance, which would have budgetary impacts here, for very little extra protection.
Right.
Courts have
can't you employ a legal strategy now to simply put all of those assets in trust and make yourself legally poor and access the state's money is now? Doesn't that happen relatively frequently?
That's relatively difficult to do, that sort of a trust situation, to retain constructive or actual control over assets while at the same time meeting the Medicaid or other state assistance criteria.
Right.
Those loopholes have been primarily closed. The courts, to get back to Senator Walker's question very quickly, courts frequently will say when we have $500,000, you're going to have two accounts, conservator. $480,000 of those dollars are going to be in an investment account that's going to be restricted, and you can't take any money out with an order from me. $20,000 will be in a checking account that you'll use for ongoing expenses. That avoids the bond. That avoids having any problems with the funds being dissipated and can be used. The problem that we're looking at with Senate Bill 35 is where we have a business which will appear on its face to be financially separate from a conservator, which in fact is not. It's my daughter's housekeeping service, and that's what she does for a living all the time. I don't get any money back from her. I don't get a kickback, but still I'm helping my family out, so I might pay her a premium because, hey, grandma's got enough money anyway. That's what we're looking at stopping, not the direct taking of the assets through subterfuge.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to kind of clarify that this is not this does not seem to me to be the final solution to elder abuse or fraud committed on the elderly. It's a small check to help prevent situations before they occur, and it's a practical matter to highlight to judges where that small universe of cases where this type of abuse might be more likely than other types. I think maybe some people are expanding the significance of this, and I think it's a small step, and I certainly commend the people who worked on this and hope that we can give a positive reading to this.
All right. Yeah. There you go.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Senator Farrelly disappeared on me. So, I don't know where he's going. He's the fellow with the concern on this thing. So, I'm going to hold this bill until it gets back and see if we can get his consent to move forward with it. So, we're going to move to Senate Bill 33. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 35. Move to public hearing on Senate Bill 33. My understanding is there's been an agreement on an amendment that makes the bill acceptable between the parties. So, where's my signature for Senate Bill 33? Do we have one? If not, the interested parties on Senate Bill 33, would you please come forward? Okay. We have one person. They probably want to do it.
No. Mr. Cooper.
Hey, good morning again.
Salutations to you. Thank you very much for being present.
Happy to.
Again, state your name for the record.
Certainly. Brooks Cooper here on behalf of the Elder Law Section and the Oregon State Bar and Senate Bill 33. This bill, if I might, Mr. Chairman, is an effort to fix what appears to me to be an unintended loophole created in 1997 with the passage of what became Oregon Revised Statute 708A.470 and 723.480. The problem that those statutes sought to remedy was when a person died and there were multiple claimants contending that the bank or credit union should give those multiple claimants the funds in the account, the banking industry quite rightly wanted some guidance on what the rules should be to avoid being in litigation every time there were separate claimants. the language that ultimately was passed has created the effect that if someone improperly has their name on an account when they are not intended to be the owner of the funds after death, the language as currently passed precludes any litigation or arbitration or other dispute resolution to enforce the deceased account holder's actual intent. And if I might give you a short example, I think it'll demonstrate why this bill is sought. What frequently happens, we just talked about conservatorships, which are awfully expensive and rarely used for people of very limited means. They'll employ an informal procedure where perhaps they'll make a son, a daughter, or a live-in caregiver a joint signatory on a bank account to help pay bills. Often through inadvertence or simply misunderstanding, the form used at the bank actually makes that co-signing person a joint account owner with right of survivorship. So by operation of banking law, at the moment the person dies, the joint account owner is the legal owner of those funds. Frequently, they will have left some sort of informal intention through a letter to the family or even a will, which says all the funds in all of my bank accounts are split evenly among my children or go into trust or whatever the testamentary intent may be. Under the currently existing language, 708A.480 and the companion credit union statute, even if we all know that the deceased person wanted the children to split the money evenly, it is conclusively determined by the signature card at the bank that the money must go solely to the non-family live-in caregiver. Courts, under the Supreme Court's PGE against Boley decision on how we interpret legislative action, are constrained to look at the plain language, and if the plain language has one sensical meaning and not more than one, so it's not ambiguous, the courts are required to apply what this legislature said, even if the consequence may have been unintended. In my practice, I routinely face circumstances like the example that I've given you, where the courts have said, I'm sorry, the money goes to the non-family live-in caregiver. I agree with you, that's not what Grandma wanted. I can't fix that. I have to do this. The fix that we're proposing in SB 33 with a minor consensual amendment that Mr. Martinez asked me to present to you, and I think you may already have a copy of it, Mr. Chairman. I can read it to you in counsel very easily. Would preserve the ability to litigate those issues when the question of the intention of the account holder is at issue, but still provide protection for the bank so that they don't end up in the middle of an intra-family squabble every time this happens. SB 33, the consensual amendment that we've talked about, you'll find on page 2 of the bill, subsection 7. At line 13, we have the word unless, colon. Is counsel there?
Mm-hmm. Line 9. Line 9, page 3.
Actually, I'm on page 2, and then we'll also page go to two. Page 3 and make okay. this. It's the same amendment to both sections. One deals with banks, one with credit unions.
All right.
And so the new language is, instead of unless colon, unless comma, prior to distributing sums to a surviving party or parties, colon, which makes it clear that the sub A and sub B, if the bank receives the notice, they can't distribute the sums until there's a resolution. That was language that, and that would also be added to the credit union statute,
say
page 3, line 9.
Say that one more time.
You bet.
Which line are you on there?
Line 13.
I'm on page 2, line 13.
Okay, got it.
Where we have the word unless colon, we would replace that with unless comma. Prior to distributing sums to a surviving party or parties, colon, and then it would go on. And that exact same amendment would be made on page 3 at line 9 to conform the credit union statute. That preserves the intent of this bill. I have no problem with that amendment. I'm happy to answer any questions that the chair, vice chair, and committee may have.
Senator Ringo.
This bill relates to banks and credit unions. What's the situation with other types of financial accounts? Might there be any confusion?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator, good question. Things like investment accounts, brokerage accounts, are covered by different statutes and rules, and this same, what I would call safe harbor, was not enacted in 97. Those are still governed by some more explicit and more detailed rules. The problem with banks and credit unions is often the only record they have of their depositors' intent is the signature card. Brokerage houses have different mechanisms, as do other investment mechanisms. So I don't see that problem there.
Thank you.
What's my name?
Chairman Venice.
That's a good start. What's my first name?
Kevin.
No,
I'm sorry.
Well, there was a guy that looked kind of like me, and his name sounded kind of like mine, who ran for governor. That wasn't me.
Did I call you Manitz?
Well, no, you called me Kevin.
I apologize.
Now, I personally like Kevin. I voted for the guy, but my name's John.
I'm sorry.
But, yeah, so I'm sure you didn't mean any disrespect, because we're both honorable men.
We are, Chairman.
And we look a lot alike, about the same height. I'm a little more handsome, I think.
I would agree.
But, okay. Good. You've been in front of judges before, haven't you?
I have, Chairman.
Have you ever gotten really outrageously angry at one?
Angry?
Yeah.
Of course.
How do you restrain yourself? You'll have to bite your lip because you can't leave the court, can't you?
Before I went to law school, I was an actor.
You were? Oh, really?
Yes.
Excellent. Well, you're like John Henry Hinkson III, aren't you?
Well.
It's pretty flamboyant now.
I'll presume that to have been a compliment.
I like it. It's kind of a pain in the neck for Kyle, particularly you are.
This is going to be a serious
call. All right. And, we need to get this drafted and move on here. Say, Mr. What's your name again? Let me see. Martinez. Mr. Martinez. This guy, he likes to sit in the back of the wheelchair. He doesn't like to come forward and actually talk anymore. He was in general government yesterday. He was kind of a burden, so. Tim, for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members on the committee, for the record, Tim Martinez, representing the Oregon Bankers Association today. We did work with the Oregon State Bar in the interim on this bill, and with the amendment that the gentleman proposed, we are very comfortable with the legislation. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Anybody want to ask Mr. Martinez?
Well,
okay.
Thank you. I didn't know I had this power. My husband was on a joint account of my father-in-law, and I had no idea we were entitled to all that money because we were being fair and honest and equitable with his brother. But I actually have the power to take it all. Would never consider doing that, so this bill's awesome. I think it's a great idea.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Any other questions? Thank you. All right, so we'll close the public hearing. We'll get the amendment on Senate Bill 33 hearing. Senator Perioli, on Senate Bill 35.
Sir.
Did you want to continue to work on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think the rest of the members of the committee like the bill.
They seem to.
I don't.
You don't like the bill?
No, sir.
So you would not be a likely carrier for the bill?
Not likely. Well, Mr. Chairman, I can carry the bill.
We don't think so.
Yeah. It's too bad we don't have some judges that we can beat up on too well.
Well,
I can get some.
I think Ms. Blake.
Yeah, it would be easy to get a judge from Marion County to come over. Yeah. Oh, this one's good.
Maybe we could, Mr. Chairman, maybe we could find some of those lazy judges that we were hearing about to come and talk to us about the bill.
There are no lazy judges.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
I can name a few, but I won't.
Ms. Blake did represent that judges have asked for this bill. Whether they're here in person to ask us, I don't think it's necessary, but she is a member of the bar. She has represented that judges have requested that we make this change.
Give a list of those judges, Mr. Chairman, who have requested the bill. I'd be maybe more comfortable.
Do you have a list of judges requesting the bill? Have you testified in front of committees in the Senate and House before, haven't you?
Not in the Senate, in the House.
In
the House,
yeah,
a couple of times.
Mr. Chairman, there's no culture.
There is no culture. So.
I believe I saw Senator Ringo in the House. Isn't that right? Senator, were you in the House Judiciary before?
Yes.
Yes,
okay.
Thought.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
Yes. Dady Blake. I'm a law attorney from Portland, Oregon. There is Judge Claudia Burton from Marion County is on our committee who was involved in this legislation that is SB 35. In addition, a bill was originally requested by Judge Rita Cobb of Washington County. Judge Welsh is
kind of like legislators in a way. It's like herding cats. They're all independently elected officials.
Right. We had asked Judge Rita Cobb, but on the notice we had, she wasn't able to clear her schedule to come today.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Any other?
Are you doing okay?
Yeah.
We haven't. Okay.
Yeah,
I'm all right. Senate Bill 35.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick, the Honorable Vice Chairman.
Senate Judiciary. Move Senate Bill 35 to the Senate floor with a due pass certification.
All right. Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 35 before the Senate with a due pass recommendation unamended. Because we do have at least one objection, I'll call the roll. There's no discussion. Any discussion? No discussion. Clerk, would you please call the roll? She did. Jane, you okay?
Yeah.
Forgot our names, didn't you? I'm Kevin. You can call me Bob, and you can call me Bill.
Senator Ferrioli.
No.
Senator Ringo.
Yes.
Senator Starr.
Yes.
Senator Walker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Burdick.
Yes.
Chairman Dennis Mann.
Aye. The motion carried, and Senator Ringo, would you accommodate carrying this bill on the floor? Well, thank you. All right, what other? All right, we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 36. Ms. Blake. Again, state your name for the record.
I'm Dady Blake from Portland, Oregon, elder law attorney representing here the Oregon State Bar Elder Law Section in favor of Senate Bill 36, which requires updating of criminal background checks. This is a fairly small adjustment to a protective proceeding statute. Under current law, a criminal background check is now done at the time the fiduciary is appointed. However, as has been stated before, in many cases, a conservatorship can go on, or guardianship can go on, for several years. As Mr. Fitzwater's testimony gives an example of one in his office that's over 14 years, this requires an annual update of the criminal background check so that the court may be aware of criminal activities that have occurred since the date of appointment. And that is it in a nutshell. It does require a professional fiduciary to file and to get such a criminal background check. And that is an inconvenience to them. However, we feel it may be an inconvenience to them. However, we feel that it would reduce risk to both minors and elderly protected persons under the system.
Does it say who does the criminal background check?
They get it themselves through the
Joe Bob's private investigation company.
I've never gotten one myself, and that's a good question. My understanding is they pay to have it done through the local county's criminal enforcement agency.
Yeah.
And how that works in each county, I'm not sure. Again, I've never done one. Good question.
I'm not sure either. The OSP does a number of them for folks, but just walk in and say, I need a criminal background.
Yeah, my understanding is for a small fee that they will give you a printout of any crimes that you've got listed.
Well, so. What suffices as a criminal investigation or criminal records check? Just you run somebody in the law enforcement data system, in NCIC, the federal system, and whatever you get back, that's it?
Chair, that is my understanding that they get it through a computer system. It's a computer printout.
Does this require that they do a check for named defendants in lawsuits and this kind of thing in civil actions?
It's only, Chair, my understanding, it's only for criminal activity that's reported, not for whether they're a party to a lawsuit, which is not...
Right. If somebody gets sued an awful lot, you probably want to know that. You know, credit history?
No. This is not requiring credit history. It's not requiring disclosure of whether you're party to a lawsuit. It is only requiring that you're updating criminal activity, if there's any to update. Yes.
All right. Senator Farrelly.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a difference between due diligence and fiduciary overkill. And, Mr. Chairman, I think this is an example of fiduciary overkill. If a person has an arrest for a criminal action, what's the time lag between an arrest and a conviction in many criminal cases?
I've got a case that has been in jail for 5 years waiting around the trial.
But he wouldn't be a convicted criminal.
Right. Under arrest.
Right. So five of the last 5 year criminal reports have shown nothing in this report. Shown, I think, 3 years interval. A reasonable interview at the role for freshening criminal background checks is certainly more reasonable than an annual update.
And help me understand how this information is helpful. Because we're asking for criminal background checks, meaning convictions.
Correct.
If you would get arrest, though,
yes,
arrest,
I was going to say, I believe any arrest would be recorded in that as well,
right.
Whether or not you'd have a conviction at that point in time.
But why wouldn't we do credit history?
Well, that's a good question, Chair, about why don't we do credit histories. In part, we've heard in previous testimony that there is a bond required. And when you get bonded, the bond company is, in fact, doing a criminal history, is doing a credit check of the fiduciary. So some of that is taking place in the bond procurement process, so the court doesn't need to do that. In order to be bonded, you need to have a reasonably good credit history. That judgment is made relative to the amount of bond. As I understand it, if you're getting a bond for $20,000, your credit history is looked at a little differently than if you're asking for a bond for $2 million, whereas you had better have substantial assets and very good credit history. So some of that is done. The court does now require, when you petition, that you disclose whether you've had a bankruptcy, whether you've convicted, of a felony, and whether you've lost a professional license. And you must accurately answer those questions to the court, and that's submitted in the petition.
Right. What happens if they're lying?
If they were found later to be lied, it'd be grounds for immediately removing them as...
Right, they're subject to federal charges.
No, there is no. The court has only the authority in protective proceeding to remove them. They could be subject to it in another proceeding, but the probate judge in civil court would be dealing with their removal. I should also disclose, as to your question about what if they are lying, just because someone has filed bankruptcy does not necessarily preclude them. You need to let the court know that. We've also had people who've committed felonies or been arrested of felonies, committed felonies unrelated to being a professional fiduciary that have disclosed to the court what the matter was related to. And there have been times when the court, with that information, still will appoint them. It's having the information the court can make the decision whether or not they would be appropriate to be a fiduciary for a protected person.
Thank you. I'd like some definition as to what is a professional fiduciary, and I'm looking at the statute here, and it says a fiduciary. It says a person nominated as a fiduciary is serving as a fiduciary who's acting at the same time as a fiduciary for three or more protected persons.
Right.
So, practically speaking, are we talking about somebody who is a
let's say, a bank trustee, or are we talking about, say, say a kid who's got three or four relatives and is just signed on to help his relatives? I mean, what are we really talking about here?
Chair and Senator Ringo, that's a good question. What is a professional fiduciary? The typical professional fiduciary is someone who does this for a living.
For example,
there typically are social workers. Sometimes they, in the Tri-County area where I primarily work, the typical professional fiduciary is someone with a healthcare background, usually with an MSW, Master's of Social Work, occasionally an RN, or other healthcare background. Occasionally it's a CPA or someone with also financial background or a combination thereof. But I find actually in practice it's generally people with social work background. These people have many more than three, although at the time starting out to do this business, the court does not consider them, quote, professional under the statute as it's defined until they have three. And then from then on, these requirements kick in. The reason for the number was to keep people who do this for parents, for example. It's not unusual for a child who might be a fiduciary for both parents or maybe a disabled child and a parent.
If you had to give a guess, do you have any estimate as to how many professional fiduciaries there are in Oregon? Are you talking about 100 people, 1,000?
Chair and Senator Ringo, I believe I don't have a listing. My guess would be that we're talking about 100. We're not talking thousands.
We're talking 100
certainly,
people.
It's certainly in the Tri-County area. I've never dealt with more than two dozen in the Tri-County area, and that's where where the majority of these cases probably are.
A couple more questions. Are you aware of problems of professional fiduciaries absconding with money and where a criminal background check might have found out the person was a bad guy and
I am, to answer the question, Chair and Senator Ringo, I am aware of a couple of situations where professional fiduciaries went astray or went bad. I am not aware specifically that the criminal background check would have made that clear to the court.
Right.
The court figured it out eventually and removed them.
You can't point to us examples of where, gee, if we'd only done a background check, we would have figured out this person was really a felon and therefore should not have been put in this trust position. You can't show us that.
I do not have any examples of those. My experience, to follow up with that question, my experience with professional fiduciaries is that these are people who genuinely care about the elderly and disabled. They've come from a background where they've showed that caring. They now have taken on the job of where there isn't appropriate family of assisting this person in health care and financial decisions. I think this, as I understand, the origin of this came from the sort of a logical extension of, wait a minute, we asked for this at the beginning, but this can go on for many, 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 many years, and we never asked to have it be updated. If it was important in the beginning, shouldn't it be important if that information changes that it be updated?
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Farrell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that an annual statement of economic interest and a credit report would be far more valuable in determining the transfer of wealth from the trustor to the fiduciary than a criminal update, because that would be effective only after the conviction. So, I understand the problem. I think for the 100 or so professional fiduciaries in the city, that's creating an interest or a requirement for an annual update on their criminal history to be filed with the court and just another piece of paper in the file. It's just not going to give the court the flag that it needs. But some mechanism like a statement of economic interest, which every elected official in the state of Oregon, compensated or uncompensated, fills out annually, discloses property holdings, loans, obligations, and that coupled with a credit report would certainly show whether there was an unusual pattern of acquisition or debt. And that would be at least far more instructive, in my opinion, than a a criminal report that wouldn't be effective until after a conviction. So, Mr. Chairman, this is a relatively pointless exercise in the statute.
Senator Humbert.
Thank you. How much would it cost? I apologize if this came up while I was out of the room, but how much do these background checks cost? Is this a high cost item?
Chair and Senator Burdick, I've never had one done myself. My understanding is it's a fairly nominal cost, although it may vary by county, but I think it's a fairly nominal cost that the professional fiduciary would undertake, not for every single case, just undertake once and then copy, related to, typically, again, in the Tri-County area, professional fiduciary will be appointed for several cases. And so they would not have to get one of these done for every single one. They would just get it done for every year, and it would apply to them, and they would file that with the court. It would be on record as professional fiduciary in the county where they had been appointed for as a professional fiduciary in cases. So, again, if they had 100 cases, they would not have to get 100 of these. They'd just do it once and file it in every county where they had been appointed.
The criminal background checks reveal unadjudicated arrests.
That's my understanding.
Convictions. If that turns up on a fiduciary, if an unadjudicated arrest turns up on a fiduciary's criminal records check, say on the initial check, what happens? Does that disqualify the fiduciary?
Chair and Vice Chair and Senator Burdick, again, my understanding and in my experience with these, disclosure does not necessarily preclude appointment or continuing as the appointed conservator or fiduciary. It depends on the nature. I have seen disclosures where fraud, financial fraud, was involved. Well, clearly the court is going to take a dim view of appointing someone where they have been either alleged to be arrested for or convicted of crimes related to that. Unrelated incidents, they may, depending on the family, in a professional fiduciary case, they're not related.
So it's a
related.
Tool, it's not.
It's a tool, exactly. It is a tool. They're not necessarily precluded.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if the professional fiduciary isn't under obligation to notify the court if they are, in fact, under arrest or prosecution for criminal action.
They're not, and this is seeking to do that.
Mr. Chairman, doesn't the judiciary already have the authority to require that if a fiduciary is arrested or accused of a crime involving malfeasance or financial gain, that they simply order the trustee to make such a report to the court immediately? I mean, Mr. Chairman, I think this authority already exists at the bench.
Right.
But I certainly don't see an annual reporting requirement as effective as some other mechanisms.
Chair and Senator, can you say your last name? I'm
Carefully.
Carefully, okay, that's easy. From what I'm hearing you're saying, and I believe it would be consistent with our intent, perhaps to amend this to require an immediate 30-60-day updating where criminal activity had occurred by the professional fiduciary in lieu of an annual report. Does that satisfy your concern?
Sure, I can see the affirmative attempt to protect trustors in this case from malfeasance of people who somehow find their way into the fiduciary role as a professional fiduciary. But an annual report filed with the clerk, which is not going to get looked at by the judge, doesn't seem to me to meet the requirement. If there is some affirmative duty on the part of the fiduciaries to report an arrest or conviction, that would be fine. That could be easily ordered by the court at the time the fiduciary arrangement was created. Both of these proposed laws, to me, seem to be better topics for bar seminars and a memorandum from the judiciary or maybe the Chief Justice to judges in the state of Oregon rather than new legislation. But yes, that would be more consistent with the intent. But, you know, the statement of economic interest in a credit report at least shows, you know, more current information and more of a pattern than a criminal report that might be stale or simply not catch what you need to, or at least be sufficiently flagged in the court system to create a hearing requirement. You know, oh, a person was arrested. Okay, does that mean that their fiduciary duties are affected? Well, what's the nature of the charge? It requires all kinds of affirmative actions by the court to get deep enough into the detail to find out whether there's a problem with the fiduciary or interest.
Right. I think it's kind of curious, to, because we've got David Daniel from LEDS and OSB here, but if there's a list of people who are professional fiduciaries, is there such a list somewhere?
There is a statewide organization of professional fiduciaries.
So when someone becomes fiduciary, they're appointed by the court, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so that name is entered into some computer record somewhere.
Certainly, Oregon judicial.
Scattered amongst the 36 counties, or
there is a network, a statewide network.
So why couldn't we do something like give each, you know, professional fiduciary an SID number that put them into the LED system, and if they did get arrested, then there would be a duty to notify the court that this person's been arrested.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that they do a criminal background check initially.
Yes, they do, sir.
So, I kind of agree with Senator Ferrioli that doing this every single year, particularly for individuals who are doing their job in good faith, it gets somewhat redundant, old, and you know, they're incurring a small financial cost for doing it, but criminal background checks sometimes take a long time, too. You can submit, if you're going to do it on a yearly basis, if you don't submit it 2 or 3 months in advance in the request, you may or may not get your criminal check back in time to continue your fiduciary duties. And I don't know what you do if it's not back yet. And, you know, I'm the fiduciary, I've submitted it to OSB, but OSB's not done with it yet, and I haven't gotten that back. And, oh, by the way, they're backed up because they don't have personnel to do it, et cetera, what happens to it. It almost seems more prudent to just give them an SID number, authorize an SID number to be assigned to any professional fiduciary, and then if they are arrested, then there's a duty to notify the court or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
David, you're back there kind of shaking your head and stuff. You want to fix you up here? We're going to end here in just about a minute, so the other two bills will come back to you tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Under ORS 125240, Section 2, Subsection A, a professional fiduciary must disclose to the court any criminal conviction of a professional fiduciary that occurs after the criminal records check is performed.
Okay. So there are
the statute.
David, your thoughts?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is David Yandell. I'm the director of the Law Enforcement Data System Division of State Police, and with me is Ms. Carmen Merlot, who is our interim manager for ID Services. There are a number of questions for us in this bill that we certainly would like to have an opportunity to discuss with our staff at ID Services. I'd like to have Ms. Merlot explain to you a bit about the open records process, which we believe is the avenue through which an individual would receive the background check that this bill addresses.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carmen Merlot, for the record. First of all, it costs $15 to do a criminal records check on an individual. In this case, the amount of information that's released is limited. You only get information on convictions in Oregon only and arrests within the prior year. You get no arrests that happened 5 years ago and there was no disposition on. So the amount of information is limited. Aside from that, if you need to do a fingerprint on the person to confirm the person's identity, that's an additional charge of, I believe, it's $18.
Right. So. Yeah, I kind of like to have their DNA up front. I know what some of people are doing. I work in the sex crimes detail. I know exactly what's going on. Anyway, so you have very, very limited information.
Very limited.
Okay. Now, what about NCIC? Does NCIC restrict the access to?
That's $24, and that can take anywhere from 2 weeks to 4 months.
Okay, so $24 plus 15 plus. Okay, so that with my little idea of assigning an SID number and flagging them in the system.
Mr. Chair, that was a question that we'll staff with our employees and get back to you on that.
Okay. All right. I mean, it seems that a lot of this data is kind of floating around out there already. And I think we do this. I mean, we do it with people who are on probation, parole. Their names come up, pop up, and they've even got the probation or parole officer to contact in the middle of the night, an emergency number, which is kind of cool. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you for being so patient.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you.
Thank you.
All right. We do have one more thing we have to do before we're done. We've got some LCs to enter, which is really? I just said the. Okay. All right. We'll do it. Mark Morrell. You probably have to be in court tomorrow. Right?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. And we're going to do Senate Bill 42 real quick. And this is a Guido Sarducci approach. Tell us everything you know about this bill.
Senate Bill 42 merely takes February 29th out of the calculation for statute of limitation purposes. We want to call a year, not 365 days.
Okay. Any opposition to the bill? Okay. Work session, Senate Bill 42.
Sure.
Senator Burdick.
I move we pass Senate Bill 42 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick moves that we send Senate Bill 42 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? No discussion. Any opposition? None. Motion passes. Can I have a motion to put this on the consent calendar?
Chair, I so move.
Senator Burdick moves that Senate Bill 42, as previously moved to Senate floor, be placed on the consent calendar for the Senate. Is there any opposition to placing the bill on the consent calendar? Hearing none. So ordered. Senate Bill 41.
41.
Public hearing.
No, I'm sorry.
That was 42.
You got it right. Okay. Now we're on 41, correct?
Correct. 41 provides that. Let me start this way. The general rule is that a statute can give you the right to attorney's fees, or a contract between the parties can. You and I can agree that if I win or you win, you get your attorney's fees. The problem comes when, as a part of the litigation, the contract is deemed void or unenforceable. Does that mean that the right to attorney's fees are then deemed void or unenforceable? Senate Bill 41 suggests no, that doesn't. That's not the way it should work. You should still get your attorney's fees. Let me give you an example. Senator Walker has a $1 million ranch right next to Crater Lake. She hires me to build a road down the side of her property. The Senate passes legislation that says that you can't build roads within 2,000 yards of a boundary of a state park or a national park. I say, hey, you owe me money for this road building project, and I sue the senator. Senator defends and says, no, the contract has become unenforceable or void because of the new law. You can't build the road. She wins. As a part of her suit, she has declared that the contract is void and unenforceable. Should she still get the cost of her attorney's fees in fighting off my claim that she has to pay me for the road? Senate Bill 41 suggests yes, she should.
Which I assume the determination would be up to the court. The court would award attorney's fees or not.
Right, and what was reasonable and what the amount is and would all be determined by the court, just like any other attorney's fees provision.
Okay. Questions?
Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Just a comment. I had a case go all the way to the Supreme Court on this exact issue. And I think this is just good housekeeping. It makes good sense.
How do you feel about this? Did you lose a bunch of money?
No, it worked out.
Good? Okay. All right. Work session, Senate Bill 41.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Burdick.
I move Senate Bill 41 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 41 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Everybody understand the bill? Okay. Within reason. Okay. Any opposition? No opposition. Senator Ferland is not present. Motion passed. And Yeah. We just moved two bills, by the way. All right.
Did I vote Senator, down one of them?
Senator Burdick also moved Senate Bill 41 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion regarding the consent calendar placement of Senate Bill 41? If not, then Senate Bill 41 will also be placed on the consent calendar. Mr. Morrell, you're a wonderful witness. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for fitting me in. I appreciate it.
You bet. Yes, I would move to bill introductions, if we could, counsel.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, members of the committee. The following legislative council drafts are for the committee to introduce through the committee. LC 1494 increases the amount of certificate of insurance issued to certain public safety officers from $10,000 to $100,000, extends life insurance coverage to all public safety officers and members of the Legislative Assembly. It's like the movie Double Indemnity. LC 1495 subjects appointment of Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to the Senate confirmation. LC 1497 creates a position on the Board of Public Safety Standards and Training for representatives of the largest collective bargaining unit of the Department of Corrections, and also creates a position on the Corrections Policy Committee for a female employee of the Department of Corrections employed at the Women's Correctional Facility. LC 1498 prohibits attorney generals from striking. LC 1499 relates to strikes under the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act, and it makes it unlawful for an employee of the Office of Emergency Management to strike. LC 1501 exempts dentists practicing emergency dentistry and dentists working for state agencies from disciplinary action for providing limited services. And LC 1742 delays the operative date for provisions restricting authority of Department of Public Safety and Standards and Training to accredit certain training programs.
All right. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we, the Judiciary Committee, introduce the aforementioned LCs as Judiciary Committee bills.
All right. Senator Burdick moves that we introduce LC 1494, 1495, 1497, 1498, 1499, 1501, and 1742. Is there any discussion regarding the introduction of these bills? If not, any opposition to introduction of these bills? There is none. Sorry, hereby introduced. They're going to take tomorrow morning off. That's good work. We, Senator Burdick and I, need to get together and figure out what other bills might be on our agenda. So tomorrow morning is free for you. We are adjourned.
Mr. Chair, I just want the committee to know I've requested that a copy of Black's Law Dictionary be available to us in the committee hearing. I actually made that request 3 years ago.